Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Yvonne Smith, your host, and this is Late Night with a Hero. Tonight we have National Council of Independent Living Centers Director Kelly Buckland on our line today. And I want to give you the call-in numbers. If you'll go now and get a pen and paper, if you are in Hawaii or in Alaska, you can use this call-in number, 855-346-3351. And in the continental U.S., 267-521-0167. We will allow call-ins at the last 30 minutes of the show. In order to for me to open the lines up, please press 1 or star 1 on your phone, and that'll let me know that you want to make a comment or ask a question. Again, the call-in number is 267-521-0167. And for those who don't have long-distance service, you can call 855-346-3351. Kelly, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure. It's nice to be on tonight.
Well, I wanted to have you on because there's many pieces of legislation that are kind of up in the air that affect people across disabilities. And also, many people may have some misconceptions about, you know, the independent living movement. I know you are a person with a disability yourself, and that you've been involved in the independent living movement now for, what, 20 years?
Actually, it's probably closer to 30 years. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. How exactly did you get involved?
Well, I got involved in disability rights actually from a Vista volunteer. I was working for the Department of Health and Welfare in Burley, Idaho, and I was doing child protection and youth rehabilitation, and this Vista worker was organizing mothers who were on welfare and organizing people with disabilities, and he got me involved, and I started doing advocacy and just really kind of got hooked and started doing it a lot on my spare time. And then eventually, like, the director of the Independent Living Center in Boise job came open, and so I applied for that, and once I got involved in independent living, I was just kind of hooked. So I've been doing it ever since. That was back in 1989 when I started that job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, for people that don't know, what exactly is independent living philosophy?
Well, independent living philosophy really is based off of several other philosophies. And it says that people with disabilities are the best experts on their needs, and therefore, you know, they really must be the ones who individually and collectively design and promote solutions for them to live more independently and to gain more power for themselves to be in control of their own lives. And it really is kind of, like I say, based off other philosophies and movements like the civil rights movement, the consumer movement like Ralph Nader, and self-help movement. You kind of see where I'm going. It's really kind of based off a number of other movements that were really popular in the 60s and 70s.
Independent.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Yvonne.
Yeah, and it's cross disability.
And the thing I was just going to mention too is it's not only cross disability, but it's it's global. I mean, there are centers for independent living around the world. So it is a global movement.
Mm-hmm. And independent living centers are now financed partly by the federal government. But most independent living centers have an array of funding that they go after. I know many of our, most of our listeners are from the mental health diagnosis world, and some may never have heard of the independent living movement. But I can say this from my involvement in it, that it is a very vibrant movement. It is, I shouldn't say even more vibrant, but people that I've met in the independent living movement, they shake the trees. Let's put it that way. And the truth in that is to look at the wide array of legislation that you and other members of NICL have gone after Congress people, state legislators, to educate them about the needs of people in the disability community. And I think that it's necessary, I would say, that anybody that has a disability or care about disabled people, they should consider joining NICL, because NICL keeps on top of the various legislations. I have not met any other organization that does this as far as doing this for the people who actually have the disability versus maybe for family members or for the industry that promotes or gets money from people with diagnoses or with disabilities. And can anybody become a member of NICL,
Mr. Absolutely. Anybody who wishes to be a member can become one pretty easily. If you go to our website, which is www.ncil.org, and on the right-hand side, there's a menu, and you click on Become a Member. It's pretty much that easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did post a little, I abbreviated your bio when I sent out information on social media and by email. So I have put the link to the website and to the policy priorities for a NICL up. So if anyone is, the people that are listening, if they want to do that, as we talk about these things, you can go and look at it. Again, our phone number is 267-521-0167. And if you are calling from Alaska, Hawaii, or you want to call in but you don't have long-distance service, you can call 855-346-3351 and press 1 or star 1, and we will have opportunity to make comment or ask questions to Kelly Buckland. And I want to give you a lot of airtime here because I know that there are several bills in Congress that affect different people, and I like the priorities that that NICL has, especially around Social Security, around mental health issues, transportation. And I, like I said, I don't know of any other group or organization that is looking after the rights and the access that NICL is doing. Perhaps only other organization I could say would parallel that would be something like AARP does for seniors. But if you are interested in looking at their priorities as we talk about them, you can go to the www.ncil.org website, and their policy priorities are right there. And Mr. Buckland, what do you think is the most important issues now for people with independent living in the United States?
Well, there's a number of them. and it's kind of hard to say which one is the number one problem or what's the number one concern, I guess.
Let's talk about a series of them because I have you on here for 2 hours, so we'll have lots of time to talk about that.
Yeah, that's kind of daunting, the 2 hours.
That's
there's a series. So I would go ahead and just kind of like start off by listing the ones that we're kind of holding out as the nickel priorities at this time. I think the number one thing that we're looking for right now is we're trying to increase in funding for independent living centers, because when we reauthorized the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act, which is where independent living is in the law, we created a new fifth core service for centers, which includes diverting people from institutions and moving people from institutions back out into the community. And we asked for that new service to be added to what we do, but we never got any new money to do it. And in order to do it well, we think we are going to need to have some more resources. And so we're asking Congress to fund Centers for Independent Living at an additional $200 million. So that's kind of one of our priorities. And that, like I say, that helps. And if you look at the policy priorities in the booklet that Yvonne has talked about, that facilitates the transitions of people with disabilities from nursing homes and other institutions back into the home and the community, and it provides assistance to individuals who are at risk of entering institutions so that they can stay in the community. And then the third thing that the Fifth Core Service does is facilitates youth with disabilities from school to adult life. And so that's why we're asking for that additional money. But then the second priority we kind of are looking at this point is voting. It's an election year, so we want to make sure that people with disabilities have a voice in this election. So we want them to know how to register to vote. We want to make sure that they're able to get to the polls to vote. And when they do get to the poll, we want to make sure that the polls are accessible to them. So when they go to cast their vote, they're able to cast a private and independent ballot so that they have the ability to cast their own vote and cast it independently in private. And then, so we're going to be spending a lot of time this year talking around how people can get registered, how they can exercise their right to vote, and we're going to also be doing a lot of advocacy to make sure when they show up at the polls, they can actually get in and cast their vote. And then,
it's oftentimes said
we
don't vote. You know, it's oftentimes said that we don't vote, but I know that's not true.
No, it's absolutely not true. In fact, there have been some surveys done that actually show that people with disabilities turn out in greater numbers than others. Unfortunately, in some states, they still have a hard time casting their vote because the process is still not accessible. So, but where they can, we really do find that people actually show up in greater numbers when it's accessible. So, and then, I mean, those are a couple of our major priorities are those. And then the third one that we have really been working hard on is the Disability Integration Act, which would make living in the community a civil right for people. And you can see it kind of goes right hand in hand with the Fifth Core Service. And so we were able to get Senator Schumer to introduce that. Working along with our friends from ADAPT, we were able to get Senator Schumer to introduce that bill in the Senate. And we're right now talking to several members of the House to get a identical bill introduced into the House. And so we're going to also be this coming year spending a lot of time and energy on getting the Disability Integration Act introduced and passed in Congress.
Yeah, we had.
So those
are
really
three
of the major priorities that we're working on.
Because I think many people, they misunderstand. They think that Olmstead took care of that, but it did not. Because
right.
Oftentimes
correct.
What's said is that it's too expensive. And that's why we have to, while on the, at least on the mental health side, people are pushing to have more people institutionalized, and people on the physical disability side find themselves sometimes in a situation wherein there aren't the necessary home services that allow people to be in their home. And when I came involved in this, I was surprised to find out a lot of the independent living centers, they spend a great deal of monies helping people have personal care attendants so that they can remain in their home. And I don't think, you know, a lot of people don't realize that that wraparound services is cheaper to provide these wraparound services so people can live independently.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's actually a major thing that centers do. Yeah. In fact, one of the things that centers did was, we have saved about $500 million in federal spending just by the number of people that we have moved out of nursing homes and other institutions back into the community just through Medicaid and other savings. So, I mean, $500 million is quite a bit of money when you're talking about a program that only gets $100 million in funding. So.
Yeah, but I also was reading that you were saying that part of NICL is to help to demedicalize a lot of the services. I know that one of the core services is peer support, and there are a lot of services that can be provided better by non-medical people versus, you know, that. I think when I was in Phoenix, I think that you said, if you didn't say this, maybe someone else said it. Did you say that when you were a young person that your family was told just to forget about you?
Well, not quite that, but I broke my neck in a diving accident when I was 16. So that was in 1970. And in 1970, the life expectancy of a quadriplegic was 3 years. So my family was told by the doctors that I would live approximately 3 years. So they basically, my family didn't expect me to live very long, and that's because that's what the doctors told them. Of course, that was now almost 46 years ago, so they were a little bit wrong on their projections there. You know, like 3 years to 46, it's a little bit off. But so anyway, yeah, you're right. I mean, we do really work to demedicalize services. We really believe that, you know, people with disabilities tend to be treated as though they're sick and they need to be cared for, and they're like they're a burden to themselves and a burden to their families and a burden to the country. And so we really talked about the fact that people with disabilities should be seen as citizens and not just secondary consumers of health care, but, you know, citizens that have a right to live in the community and a right to exercise the same level of control over their lives that everybody else does. And so that's, I really kind of think, what the crux of the independent living philosophy is that, you know, we should have the same level of control over our lives everybody else does. We're going to need supports, but everybody needs supports. I mean, society is built on supports. That's why we have infrastructures. That's why we've built up all these other processes and supports to help people with their daily living. We just need different supports than other people do. So,
at the same time, it seems as though that we are victimized a lot of times by police, law enforcement. I know one of the bills that you're looking after is that I didn't realize that there's an active segment victimizing and trafficking, sex trafficking of people with disabilities. And just the recent, a lot of the police actions are toward people who have disabilities, especially people who may have emotional stress where in the police call, there's a certain amount of excessive force that's going on there. And, I know when I went to the United Nations, I asked our government representatives not to use the police in that manner. But I noticed that there's been 125 fatal shootings by police in the first 6 months of 2015. And I don't see any let up in that.
Right. There's actually as you've well pointed out, a lot of people with disabilities have been treated badly by police, even killed. And there's been a lot of publicity around that lately. The White House had a forum around that this past summer. In fact, a lot of the killings of people of color, and then you can draw a lot of parallels around police killing of people with disabilities. I mean, and there's a lot of different reasons for that, but one of them, I think, is really kind of training for police to understand disability and understand how to approach people with disabilities. And as you've well pointed out, Yvonne, a lot of people with mental illness are not treated properly by police, and I think a lot of that has to do with the lack of training. So,
And not only lack of training, but somewhere way back, they coupled dangerousness, mental health, mental illness, and together. So when that gets decoupled, that might help us there. And I know that Nickel has been very instrumental in working against the Murphy bill as well. Do you see any chance that bill will be defeated before? Once again, because it seems like it's a bad penny. It keeps coming back.
Yeah, we are adamantly opposed to the Murphy bill for all the reasons that most of the mental health community is opposed to this, and the mental health consumer community is opposed to it. It just does all the wrong things. If you want to improve the mental health system, you have to improve the services, meaning that services have to be more robust, they have to be more consumer-driven, and people have to want to seek them out. And the way the Murphy bill is structured, it does just the opposite of that. I mean, it's going to make people not want to seek out services because under that bill, you're not going to get the services that you most want to get, and a lot of the services that you are going to get are going to be mandatory compulsory, meaning that you won't have any choice around it. And so people are going to not be seeking services more. They'll be avoiding the system more. And plus, I don't think, he's not listening to the will of people with disabilities. when he's crafting the bill, he's listing the family members, and they want to control their family members, not necessarily let them have more control over their lives, which is contrary to independent living. So, yeah, we're adamantly opposed to the bill. I think there is a good chance we can defeat it. And although, as you know, Yvonne, the mental health stuff is on the fast track in the Senate. The thing I think we have to hope for is that the bill that's drafted in the Senate is going to be more reasonable, and they're going to have listened to the needs and desires of people with disabilities more when they craft the bill. So I think that's what we have to really pay attention to. And I think the two most important people to talk to right now are Senator Alexander and Senator Murray from Washington.
And Alexander from Tennessee.
I've talked to both. Exactly. And I've talked to both Senator Alexander's staff, and I've talked to Senator Murray's staff. And we've expressed our discontent with the Murphy bill, on both Murphy bills, like the one in the Senate and the one in the House. And we've told them all the reasons that we don't like those bills, and we're hoping that they're listening to us. So.
And I want to say something about the extent of the independent living movement. There was nothing like my first time being in a NICL conference the year before. I've only been to two. Wherein, if people on this call can imagine, if you live in Washington, D.C., or if you have ever been to Washington, D.C., the Capitol is central to the city. And from the hotel at 11th Street, there was a line from 11th Street to the Capitol with people who are disabled and wheelchairs on crutches that were descending on the Capitol, so that when congressmen and senators would look out the window, this is sort of the powerfulness of this organization, they could see as far as they could see disabled people. And I've seen this before too at other times, but I didn't know what it was, descending on the Capitol with their priorities in hand. With NICL does a great job of putting information together. The various committees in NICL, if you're a NICL member, like I'm on the mental health committee, we talk by telephone every month. And there is an organized effort to educate your congressperson and your senator, and then the individuals are given the information that they need when they go home to continually try to educate Congress, the Senate, and their state legislators. And there's nothing like that. If you ever have a chance to come in July when there's a NICL conference, and I know everyone can't do that, but people can talk to their congressperson and their senator. And we're going to get back and talk about some more of the things. But, Kelly, can you give people some pointers on how to engage their congressperson or senators on these various issues? Are there some key things that they should remember, or how to engage with the congressperson or senator?
Well, or yeah, staff? I mean, there are. I'm really glad to hear you talk so positively about the march to the Capitol, because we have a lot of people who have never done that, and when they do it for the first time, Yvonne, they're so empowered by that. They go home and talk about it for some time to come, and this year was very powerful. Like you said, we had people marching. The line went back
people.
As far as. Yeah, back as far as you can see, I mean, it was pretty amazing. And so, if you do want to attend one of the marches, you know, people come to the conference and they have to pay a registration fee to attend the conference. And the march is part of the conference, but we don't, we kind of let anybody who wants to come to the march come. We think it's a thing that belongs to people with disabilities, and we want to see people participate. So if you're in town when we're having our march and you want to join us, we welcome you to do that. And I think you'll find it very fun. But so to get back to your question, though, we actually do a training probably sometime in June before people ever come. And it's a conference call that we do. And we have all of our committee chairs there and speak about all the different issues. And we tell people that before they ever come to D.C., they should call their representatives and their senators and make an appointment. So when they get here and we do the march and then we have the rally at the Capitol building, then people go up and visit with their senators and representatives, they already have a pre-arranged appointment when they get here. And so they can go up and pass out all of our disability policy priorities. And basically, last summer, during the conference, every single senator and representative from around the country's office was visited by people with disabilities, and they talked about our priorities. So that training's the first thing. Then people come to the conference. We have a legislative and advocacy workshop where we talk about all the different policy priorities that we have and all the different positions that we have. Each committee chair then go through that with people who are attending the conference. And then everybody's given a policy priorities booklet, so when they go to the Capitol, they have those to pass out. And then it's online, and the people who are not able to come, which you very well make a good point, Yvonne, people can still visit with their congressmen and representatives back home, or they can visit with their staff back home and make their voices heard in their local communities. In fact, a lot of times your senators and congressmen will listen to their constituents in their own state more than they will people from D.C. So you can have an impact there, while your peers who come to D.C. can have an impact here, and you get a dual impact that way. That's really good. But some kind of guidelines I would just tell people is, you know, be truthful with people. Never tell a lie. If you tell people a lie, you'll lose all credibility immediately. If they ask you a question, you don't know the answer, instead of trying to just respond on the spot, if you don't know, just say, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll go research it, find out, and get back to you. And that's really the best, because your word should be your bond. And so you give somebody your word, you stick to it, and then they'll trust what you're saying about the policy. They'll trust what your opinion is. They'll trust you, and you'll become one of their most trusted advisors. And so I think that's, you know, be courteous. Doesn't mean you can't be firm. I mean, if you're going to be an advocate, you got to be firm on your positions. But, you know, you can be courteous and respectful at the same time. So I think those are some, you know, just some basic guidelines that I would encourage people to follow. And then be educated about what it is you go in there to talk about. Know the legislation you're talking about. Know what position you want to advocate for. And then stand your ground and advocate for it.
Yeah, good tips there, good tips. And I just want to underline what you were saying, because I think many people that listen know this, but everybody may not. Almost every congressperson has a constituent office back home, and that's what you were referring to. And I think that you're more apt to see the individual in the home state versus when people come to Washington. Oftentimes they see a staff person, which is not bad, because they usually help write the policy papers and actually do a lot of the wordsmithing of the bills anyway. But to get that, especially this is going to be a very important election time for a lot of people. A lot of seats, senatorial and Congress seats, will be up, and people will be looking to make sure that they shore up their base. And as you said, people with disabilities, you know, it's a myth that we don't vote. We vote very, very heavily, and I don't understand why some people think that they have to mock us, but we do vote very heavily. And one other thing, what about taking literature and stuff with you to the congressperson? Should you take a whole bunch of stuff or just one sheet, or what's the best thing to do?
I think they really appreciate it up on the Hill when you bring something that's brief, concise, and to the point. Carrying too much is just that they're not going to read it. Our policy booklet is fairly long, and they probably won't read it all, which is why we have people outline their priorities when they talk to them, and they can point out the sheets that each priority really only covers like a sheet and a half or so. And so that you can point them to those priorities, and so they don't have to read the whole book. But it's there if they want to. I think it's good to be able to provide more information if they want it and follow up later. But they really do appreciate something that's brief and concise and kind of to the point.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the part on mental health, and that's like 2 pages.
Yeah, almost there, every policy.
And it's like 2 pages. I mean, this is this is very well put together. I know that you and your staff do an excellent job with outlining table of contents of various areas that are of interest to us. And even though mental health is very much of importance to me, there are other areas that affect me as a disabled person as well, you know, like housing, Social Security benefits. I think that Nickel has the right idea about changing. I was part of a group called Advocates for Work, but changing the substantial gainful employment and the ability to save money through the ABLE Act. And many people don't know about that, but Social Security sort of discourages people from working. But I like the recommendation of having people disregard 50% of the substantial gainful activity and then just reducing it one for $3, because it discourages people from working. And it just puts people in a disability chain, which they don't need to be in.
Right. Yeah, we get trapped into poverty from that. And so we've been working on this for a really long time. Yeah, we've been working on this for a really long time, Yvonne, and I'm glad you recognize that. I mean, we're really trying to free people from that. That catch 22 where you have to swear you can't work in order to get disability benefits, but then that's what they want you to do, is go back to work. But if you do, then you lose all your benefits. So, yeah, we've been working on this for a really long time and unfortunately haven't been making a lot of gain. I think some of even our own comrades in disability advocacy don't agree on this and are afraid to change anything about Social Security, but it's a system that was developed, you know, 40 years ago, and it hasn't changed a whole lot. When I went to college, I was on SSI, and so this was back in the early mid 70s, and back then I was living in a nursing home because there wasn't any home and community-based services back then.
You were living in a nursing home?
I lived in a nursing home.
You were living in a nursing home?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I was about about 9 months when I first started college, I was living in a nursing home. So when you live in an institution like that, and you get Social Security. They take all of your Social Security, but they leave you what they call monthly stipend for living.
Like $50 or $100.
Yeah, back then it was 25. In 1975, 74, it was $25. And now I think in most places it's like 40. And do you know what $25 would buy in 1975 versus what $40 will buy now? I mean, it hasn't kept up with cost of living at all. And then back then you could also have up to $2,000 in resources or $2,000 in savings in the bank, and you can still have $2,000 in savings. So that hasn't changed at all in like 40 years. So it's sort of ridiculous that it hasn't changed and kept pace with the times. I mean, it's very sad, actually. So people have a really hard time getting enough benefits to live on, and then it takes so long to get that stuff put into place that they're not willing to jeopardize it to go to work. And it's very understandable because, I mean, it's really difficult to get that stuff put into place and you want to see it go away. So I just saw a report on Friday, actually. You know, the unemployment in the country has continued to go down while the unemployment rate for people with disabilities continues to go up. So it's getting worse for us even when it's getting better for most people. So we really do have to get them to change how this whole thing works.
And then people are in a catch-22 situation because they need the assistance, and then if they feel as though if they work, they lose their Medicaid or whatever, which is not true. But as you said, people are discouraged. You know, it took such a long time. I mean, I know people that are quadriplegics that they were turned down for Social Security and they had to apply, or a person was turned down, and it's just, you know, a horrible experience that in other countries they don't make people do this to make you, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but make you hopeless that you can't do anything, you know, to get that little bit of money
right. That
is necessary for people to survive. And as you said, it's not just nursing homes. There are people in group homes, especially a lot of people in the mental health community or in the developmental disability community. There's a large number of people who are making a lot of money off of people in nursing homes as well who are elderly, where they take almost all of their money except for a little bit, and there's no hope because they can't dig their way out. There's no way, because the little amount of money, whether it's $100 or $40 that the person has every month, they can't save enough for an apartment. There's some special program or something to be put aside to help them. So it's not that. I want to give again our telephone numbers. If people want to ask questions or comment, they need to press 1 or star 1 on their phone. Our guest call-in number is 267-521-0167. If you're calling from Alaska, Hawaii, it's 855-346-3351. Again, the call-in number is 267-521-0167. And I just want to say, you know, NICL is a tremendous resource, cross-disability. As far as the advocacy that the organization NICL does, and I was up 2 weeks ago on Capitol Hill at the congressional reception, and just to see the other advocates from other areas coming together and the huge amount of respect that congresspeople and senators, they came out, and even people from the the Office of Disability in the White House that had for NICOL. You know, even when we had that every year when they had the rally, I think how many congressmen and senators came to I shouldn't say march. It was a rally. How many people came? I mean, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah,
we had
Bernie Sanders was there. We had over 20 members of Congress speak at the rally last summer. Yeah, that was our biggest showing ever, and 20 of them coming to speak was pretty daunting. Just trying to get everybody up on the stage when they get there, because as you remember, the rally only lasts about 45 minutes to an hour, and so to get them all up there and give them time to speak, especially when you're standing out there in the hot sun in late July. It's kind of hard to get them all up there, but yeah, we had over 20 members of Congress speak, including the presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, and so yeah, it's pretty cool. And at the reception you're talking about, Yvonne, we had 4 members of Congress who were there and spoke. We had 2 senators, Senator Schumer and Senator Isaacson, and we had 2 House members, Representative Handy and Representative Thompson, G.T. Thompson. So we had 2 Democrats, one in the House and one in the Senate, and 2 Republicans, one in the House and one in the Senate. So it was a nice even split from both houses and both parties. So, and we had a lot of staff there from a lot of other offices who showed up, you know, talking about Senator Murray from Washington, who's working on the mental health legislation. Her staff were there at the legislative reception, and the staff of the health committee were there too. Senator Alexander's staff were going to come. In fact, I talked to them right beforehand. They said that they would be there. But something must have come up because they didn't end up making it, or at least I didn't see them there anyway. So, but yeah, we had a really good showing and a lot of support. So, and it was nice seeing you there. And you attended the NICOL board meeting too, I think, didn't you?
Yes, I did. But yeah, I just like the way the organization is going about hitting Congress and hitting senators. And I think that that within the disability movement, other people have a lot to learn from NICOL, and that NICOL is looking at things cross disability, you know, not just one little segment, the whole aspect of disability and human rights, whether it's the Convention on Rights and of Persons with Disabilities, or whether it's assistive technology or voting rights, employment rights, all of these things that that you're looking at. It's like you're looking at the individual as a whole person, and not just that how they gain access to service, but the other things that are affecting people's lives. And I just think that it's something we should be a part of. And that if we're going to defeat people like that have these medieval ideas about people with disability, whether it's physical disability or mental health. I know we can have an argument about whether it's a disability or not, but people that are being victimized by other people, wherein there's an industry that gets a lot of stuff from us, but sometimes does not serve us very well. But you know, pushing forward for people to be independent is the best thing. And I want to say, if anyone, I see we have lots of people on the line. I don't see anything lit up, but if you want to comment or ask a question, and I'll come back to you about the convention, Kelly. You can press 1 or star 1 to come in on the line. I don't know if something is wrong with the line or not, But I'll open it up in case there are people that may have questions or want to comment. So I'm going to open up some of the lines right now. Okay. Area code 310-315-703. Okay, I guess not. Usually I get little messages from people say. I think
Hello.
Someone said something. Yes?
Don? Hi, this
yes.
is Maxine. I have a question for Kelly. A couple, actually. Can you hear me?
Yes. Are you in area code 310?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Kelly, I was looking at your housing priorities, you know, under your priorities, protecting and expanding our housing opportunities. You know,
yeah.
housing is basic to everything, employment, everything, staying out of long-term facilities and so forth. Is NICL involved at all with speaking to HUD about the disparity with, for example, the Section 8 program, where the payment standard is way too low in many areas for people to live independently or even get an apartment?
Yeah, we are. I mean, we've been talking to HUD on an ongoing basis for, like, well, as long as I can remember. And I don't know if you know, but way back in the day, actually, NICL sued HUD over Section 202 housing. I don't know if you remember that, but it was when they were building housing that only people with disabilities could live in, like it was
yeah.
segregated housing. And we sued them over that. So we've been working with HUD on these issues for a very long time. Unfortunately, it seems right now we're going backward. I mean, there are going to be fewer vouchers under through this year than there were even the last year. And as you know, like under Section 8, there's such a waiting list that even though people with disabilities get a priority on the waiting list, especially those who are institutionalized, there's still a waiting list that you have to get onto to get even eligible for Section 8. So, yeah, I mean, there's a real lack of funding. There's not enough accessible units. There's not enough affordable units. And you're absolutely right. It makes it really hard to get people out of institutions when there's no housing to move into. So it makes that fifth core service we were talking about earlier in the conversation
transition.
Even harder to achieve because there's no housing out there. Now, the Disability Integration Act that I talked about that would guarantee people a civil right to live in the community, that would require states to come up with plans to change stuff in the state to make it so everybody could work or live in the community. And so basically they would have to come up with a plan and methodology to increase the amount of affordable and accessible housing so that people would have an ability to live in the community. And then they would have 10 years to do that in, and then they would get an increased FMAP under Medicaid to help them do that. So that's one thing that also addresses housing. Most people think about it just more being like a civil right to live in the community, but it would actually require states to come up with a plan on how they're going to increase affordable and accessible housing.
And that's why employment is...
There are communities right now where people are already on Section 8 and they are under such a heavy rent burden they can't afford to stay in their homes. Particularly here in the state of California, there was an article that came out recently that most people can't even afford to live in Los Angeles, much less the Bay Area, and it is prevalent. And there's all kinds of documentation to back all that up and everything. And I think Nichols should take a look at what's happening in California and also talk to HUD about expanding the payment standard criteria.
I think that
so
what
stay in their homes, because so many people are at risk of institutionalization because they can't maintain their present Section 8.
Maxine, I think that's what Kelly and Nichol have been involved in that for quite some time.
Now there's so much existing, particularly in the state of California, Northern California and Southern California, where the evidence is so prevalent that to use that as a, you know, the documentation and so forth on a national basis, called exception to the payment standard, where, you know, places that have already have the exception to payment standards are still way too low for people that have been on Section 8 to maintain their housing.
I actually have been following what's going on in California, and I've been following the budget in California, the 7% that you guys lost in the budget and that they're proposing to put back in this time. And I don't know how anybody affords housing in California. I mean, but people on Section 8, it's got to be incredibly hard. I mean, if you look at the report that came out about SSI and living in the community and how people afford housing, I think the report's actually called Priced Out of Housing or something like that. Or priced out. I mean, that's true around the country, but it is absolutely particularly true in California because the housing costs in California are so extraordinarily high and just place such a burden on people with disabilities to be able to pay rent.
We have the same problem in D.C.
So, well, it's the same problem in D.C. It's a problem in D.C. and a problem in New York, but I think it's exceptionally bad in California. The housing prices in California are just really high. So,
yeah, I went to a workshop with someone from California, and I think they were, I can't remember the name of the place, but it was near Silicon Valley, and they said, we don't even have Section 8. You can't even work that, because when you talk about 30 or 40% of a person's Social Security, you know, the they're talking housing is $2,500, $3,000 a month, so they can't even talk about that. I wonder if that mortgage interest deduction reform act, would that help any? Kelly?
Oh, what did you call it?
The Mortgage Interest Deduction Reform, H.R. 1662. Would that help any?
Oh, I'm not even familiar with that one. I'll have to look that one up, Yvonne.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a bill that would fund the National Housing Trust Fund and Capital Magnet Fund. I didn't know if that would help or not, that's why employment is so important. I'm sorry, go ahead, Kelly.
Well, I was just wondering if that was the Housing Trust Fund legislation you're talking about.
There's two of them. Funding for the National Housing Trust Fund, and the other one is Mortgage Interest Deduction Reform.
Mm-hmm. Oh, then it's not the same thing. I thought they were tied. But.
The National Housing Trust Fund has been around for many, many, many years, and now, you know, they're supposed to be releasing some money. But, you know, I don't see where we've ever seen it. for people to use it for with disabilities for housing.
Does NICL have a housing committee?
We do.
Mm-hmm.
That's very active, actually. It's chaired by a gentleman called Brian Peters, and he's with the Center for Independent Living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is Independence First. And Brian's on the NICL board. You've probably met him at the board meeting, Yvonne. He's
mm-hmm.
the guy that was there who was deaf. He's in the sign language
yeah.
interpreter. So.
Yes. Because there are several committees that they have, and the committees are I have to say, they're quite active. I have to say, one thing is that NICL has this, if you want to be involved, you can. And a lot of times people talk about transparency. If you want to find something out, that you can find it out, and they communicate with people. If anybody else has any other questions or comments, as I said, I've opened the lines up. If you have a question or comment, that you can do that. I know that you might be getting tired, Kelly, because you said 2 hours is kind of long for you. But
I have another question regarding employment.
Well, let's see if someone else has a question first, Maxine, and then you can come back
sure,
to you,
okay?
Okay. Does anyone else have any comments or questions for Kelly? And I asked what area code you were because I was getting some backdrop. I guess not. Maxine, go ahead. Maxine?
Yeah, unemployment, there is all kinds of ways to not lose benefits if somebody wants to go to work that's on disability. Do you know about those, like the Ticket to Work program, and or if someone wants to go in through vocational rehabilitation, they won't lose their benefits. And if they work a certain amount of time and can't make it, they can go right back on disability again.
Mm-hmm. I think that what, Kelly, can you explain more about some the programs that NICL is advocating for? Because I think it's more than that. Right now, what happens, people have to make less money. Under those programs that you're talking about, Maxine, you have to stay below a certain limit or certain expenses. I think that what NICL is talking about is just something radically different, right?
Well, no, I mean, what we're talking about is, frankly, in my opinion, the Ticket to Work program has been one of the biggest failures in recent history. Very few people have a ticket and know what to do with it. And basically, the Social Security Administration bureaucratized what was like incredibly good legislation that got a lot of people excited. The Social Security Administration bureaucratized it to the point that it's really not that beneficial. The main thing that's really helped from Ticket to Work, in my opinion, are the Medicaid buy-in programs, which almost every state has now. And they were, in, I think, the biggest help to people going to work under Ticket to Work. I think they have made a difference. The problem is there are work incentives under SSI. But under SSDI, you hit a cash cliff, which is really what NICL's proposals are about, is to make the SSI or SSDI program function more like the SSI program, where you get a dollar deducted from your benefit for every two you earn, except we're suggesting that people get a dollar deducted from their benefits for every three they earn under SSDI. But, you know, the cash cliff under SSDI really prevents a lot of people from even going to work. And then there's basically a process that happens in schools now where parents are told to get their kids signed up for benefits, And once they get on benefits, it makes it harder to get off. And I know the Ticket to Work program has some incentives in there to do that, but I don't think they're well understood by the general public. I don't think most people with disabilities know how they work. And the WIPA programs, which is the Work Incentive Planning and Assistance Act, or Planning and Assistance Program, isn't adequately funded, so not enough people get access to counseling on how
it's
to use
self-funded.
Work incentives. And so, basically, I don't think that those work incentives are well understood, well used, and I still think a lot of people have so much distrust in Social Security that they don't believe that half the stuff that they're told. And so I think that it really still has to be some fundamental reforms to Social Security and the work incentives. Well, I explained a little earlier how it worked when I was on it like 40 years ago. And the overpayments that I got, after I told everybody I went to work and I shouldn't get any more Social Security checks, I still continued to get them. And that's another major problem that still exists today. People get overpayments even though they've told people to stop their benefits. And they think they're actually due the benefit, so they go ahead and spend it. And then they have to come up with thousands and thousands of dollars to repay. You know, in my case, I repaid it as it came in, but I had to keep receipts because Social Security came back after me and said that I still owed the money even after I paid it back. And they did that again a year later. So, I mean, I don't have a lot of trust in Social Security, and I don't think most other people do either who are on it and want to go back to work. So there's a whole bunch of reasons that it doesn't work. So it really does need to have some fundamental reforms. In my opinion, I think Nicole agrees.
So what you're saying is I want you to go back over that. That proposal was to simplify it so that Social Security disability would be more like SSI. So you keep a certain amount, and then the excess of that, you'd only get reduced $1 for every three.
Correct. And
because,
then we also are trying to push the Career Access Program, which would give people from 18 to 30 actually the ability to work and not lose any benefits. You want to know the truth? I think actually Nickel believes that what we should do is make SSDI more and SSI more like the old age assistance, where people go back to work and they don't lose any benefits. I mean, the way we have it now is that people don't work and they still get their benefits. At least if people were working and getting benefits, they would be paying taxes into the system. The way it works right now, people don't work, they can't get out of poverty, and they continue to get the benefits anyway. So,
And all you do is to help make the providers take care of their needs because... There isn't the incentive to get off of benefits because you may need the medical care, so you're in like a catch-22 situation, a trap, as you would say.
It's been my understanding that if someone goes in and wants to go to work and is successful in going to vocational rehabilitation, you know, state vocational rehabilitation, that their benefits are protected by that program, just by being a recipient of services from State Department of Rehabilitation.
It's a little more complicated than that because many people that get ticket don't realize that in 5 years you're supposed to be off of benefits totally. So it is a little bit more complicated than that, and the overpayment situations are really devastate people.
I'm not talking about ticket support program. I'm talking about directly with vocational rehabilitation. It doesn't, rehabilitation doesn't necessarily use Ticket to Work. There's protections when you go to and become a participant with state vocational rehabilitation, that they see to it that your benefits are protected while you're under that program. I think you
I'm not sure about that, but
you're talking about two different things. Well, you're not sure about it. Check it out.
Because there are lots of people that have overpayments, but like I say, I'm not. I just say that, you know, you should talk to Social Security about that, because I know when I got a letter saying that I had a $70,000 overpayment, it was devastating. Of course, it wasn't that, but they went back from when I applied for Social Security, and I even had some disability payments from an insurance company that they counted as wages. So it is a complex. I think what Kelly is saying is it's very complex. And,
well, being,
and
being under vocational rehabilitation does not protect you from losing your benefits if you go to work. I don't know where you heard that, but I've never heard that before. And I know people who are on vocational rehabilitation, and if their wages go above the gainful activity, they're going to lose their Social Security benefits.
There's always time limitations to it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. And before we run out of time, Kelly, can you say something about the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities? Why does it really matter to people in the U.S. That this be approved by the Senate? Because right now, that particular bill is not going anywhere.
Well, I think it matters because, as I mentioned before, independent living really is a global movement, and so are disability rights. So those of us who live in the United States and enjoy the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act should fight for our brothers and sisters in other countries so that they have the same rights that we do. It also matters because if we travel to another country, we want to have our rights protected when we go there, which a lot of people do. A lot of veterans travel to other countries. I know my predecessor, the executive director of NICOL, was John Lancaster, and John got his disability as a result of a wound he received in Vietnam. And he traveled back to Vietnam quite frequently to help the people of Vietnam actually try to get more disability rights in the country. And a lot of other veterans do the same thing. They travel back to countries that they were in service in. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it matters for all those reasons. And I also think that, you know, this country does lead in disability rights. And so I think we have an obligation to help lead in the rest of the world. And the disability rights, the Convention on Disability Rights, was really something that we helped develop, and we had a lot of input into. And now, because we haven't ratified, we don't have a seat at the table internationally when they meet around the convention. So it's important for a lot of those same reasons. But I think most of all, it really does matter because we are a world leader in disability rights, and we should be in a position to say that we we believe in the convention that we had a big part of developing. So I hope that helped. Plus, we were so close. I mean, we were so damn close. It's really a shame that we couldn't get it over the finishing line.
I got some notes here. I don't know what this means. RUDs? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. RUDs are reservations, understandings, and declarations. And so when countries sign on to a treaty, they make all of those things. So the United States had issued RUDs on the Convention of the Rights of People with Disabilities. And so there was debate around those reservations, understandings, declarations, and but I think in the end, the ones that were issued were basically agreed upon by everybody. And so you would have thought that that would have meant that we would have had the majority we needed to get it passed and ratified in the Senate, but we fell like 5 or 6 votes short.
Mm-hmm. And here, someone asked this question. Do you see the possibility of CRPD being invoked to abolish, like, forced treatment in the United States?
Well, we haven't signed on to the treaty, so
mm-hmm.
it's not in effect. Even if we did, the RUDs essentially said that it wasn't self-executing and it it didn't require any laws to be changed in this country.
Mm-hmm.
That's those reservations, understandings, declarations that we made. And so I think that would be a very difficult thing to make happen just because of the, well, one, the fact we never ratified it, and two, all those RUDs that we did, essentially, I think would make it very difficult, if not impossible, to do that.
Make it very what?
Difficult, if not impossible, to do that.
Okay. Is anyone asking the Senate to remove some of them?
Well, I think that was a lot of the debate that occurred around those RUDs were, you know, I think a lot of people wanted them to be stronger, especially advocates from the disability rights community wanted those to be stronger. So,
Do you know what Bernie Sanders' position is on that? Or have you talked to him about it?
You know, I don't. I don't know what his position was on that. We have a survey that NICL and AAPD are doing together, and it asks that question, though. So we haven't been surveying candidates in the primaries, but once we get into the – once the nominees are announced, we'll be issuing that survey for them to address, and then we'll know what their positions are on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I know you're up on the Hill quite a bit.
Yeah, and I'm sure he voted for it, so I think he supports it. I know he voted for it. Every Democrat voted for it.
Okay. We have maybe about 15 more minutes, and I just wanted to see if there's anything else, Kelly, you'd like to say to our audience, or the audience has any other questions. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, I do. Someone here is asking, will you support the FDA petition to not to move ECT devices from a schedule 3 down to 2? And what is NICL's position on ECT. And do you know what I'm saying when I'm asking that? Electroshock.
Ask me what, tell me, I thought that's what you meant, but I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Our position on that is that electroshock should be eliminated, should be abolished,
period.
Run away with. Shouldn't be happening. Exactly. Period.
Okay. Okay. So this person is asking, will you support the petition on that? I'll send that to you. Support the... Is this Nichols' position or your position?
It's Nichols' position, and we have signed on in support of the petition.
Okay, you have signed on. Okay, I hope that helps that person. They just said thank you, because I have Facebook and Twitter open.
I signed on to it personally, too. I signed the position personally, and Nichols signed on as well. So.
Okay, that's wonderful there. Okay, any other questions or comments? I'm getting a little pings in the background because I'm getting people saying positive things about that they're very happy that Nichols has signed on. And I want to say again that people that want to join Nichols can go to the website. It's www.nicil.org. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
When you go to join, there's a $35 fee, but we're more interested in having you join than we are in the $35. So the board has empowered me to negotiate people with their dues. So if you're unable to afford $35, still want to be a member of Nichols, you can just contact me and tell me what you can afford, and we'll go from there.
Okay, and there is a contact info sheet on the Nichols page, too, so that you can contact Nichols and ask for, a sliding scale or...
Just to negotiate your dues with me, yeah.
Negotiate, so you can
we don't do
get...
It. There's no sliding scale,
your...
They just tell me what they can afford, and we'll go from there.
They can tell you what you can afford. And then being a member of Nichols, that way you can get on those various committees, and I said that the committees are very active around these issues. And as you can tell from listening to Kelly, that Nichols is very active, the membership is very active, and we've really got to cross this ability. We've really got to work this together because we just have to. We have to get together and do that. Are there any other questions out here? I have lines open or to send them to Twitter or to at YZ Smith or to Facebook by PM.
Yvonne, I have one more question about the Disability Integration Act.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so far there's three co-sponsors to Disability Integration Act. What is Nichols doing to get more sponsors for Disability Integration Act? And can you please tell us the information on how it is different from present protections related to the enforcement provisions?
Yeah, I mean, we are doing a lot of things around getting more co-sponsors, but we're specifically asking people to contact their representatives and their senators, specifically right now because we don't have a House bill, to contact their senators and ask them to sign on. So we're really asking people like you to contact your senator, ask them to sign on in, as a co-sponsor to the Disability Integration Act. And the way it differs
it should be a no-brainer.
Law, The way it differs from current law is that the Olmstead decision, which was under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has a non-discrimination mandate, what you call a least resistant or least, less restrictive environment, the least restrictive environment. The way it differs from that is the Olmstead decision basically says you have a right to live in the community as long as your doctor says you can, as long as you can do it safely, as long as you can get onto a waiting list and wait until you're able to get off the waiting list. This has none of those, the Disability Integration Act has none of those contingencies. So it's not up to your doctor. You don't have to necessarily live in the community safely. Nobody actually lives in the community completely safe. And then the third thing is you would have a civil right to live in the community, an absolute civil right, not one that can be you can be put on a waiting list and wait for years in order to get services. It's not tied to services. It's tied to civil rights. And so that's really the difference, is it's not tied to a specific service. It's really just tied to your right to live in the community. And it wouldn't have those trappings under the Olmstead.
I can send you the bill.
I would just like Kelly to explain the enforcement provisions of the bill. There's enforcement to it. That's why it has teeth.
Correct. It would basically be enforced like every other civil right. You would actually have the ability to go and have your civil rights enforced, and that would be one of them, is to live in the community. And as I mentioned before, every state would have to come up with a plan to make that happen. They would have 10 years to do it in. And the plan also has to be enforced. And some of that's enforced actually through HHS. Some of it would be enforced through DOJ. So, I can send Yvonne something that actually talks more specifically about that, and Yvonne maybe feed it out to the audience that talks more specifically to the enforcement stuff.
Thank you, we greatly appreciate that.
We greatly appreciate that, because even when we had Bruce on, because many more people listened to the podcast later, there were questions about that. How could it be possible? And, some of the language in the bill said to the extent possible. Some of the language that's there. It was a great improvement over Olmstead, because like you said, all of these other trappings that they have reasons that they can do that. And I just got a message from the producer of the show thanking Nickel for all that they're doing, Dr. Lauren Tenney. So people are very appreciative of that. And like I said, I hope more people will become involved in NICL, because it's a great organization, and even if no more than just for the advocacy, it's true to our efforts for community integration and independent living. Kelly, before we go, I just want to say thank you again for coming on the show, and would you come back again from time to time to update us? Maybe not.
Absolutely.
2 hours is a long time for you, but if you could come, and I'm going to be working out a way in which maybe sometime we might be able to video stream stuff. So it's very important that people know what's happening. Any other last words about advocacy, as far as I know we need to push for this Disability Integration Act, and also to educate our representatives on the Murphy Bill, and if you go to the if people go to the website, they can see all of the NICL priorities, and you can sign up to join NICL. It's a worthwhile organization. There's a lot of benefits to being a NICL member, to finding out about all of these things that's happening, and NICL really keeps its membership informed of what is happening, and the policy priorities come from the grassroots. Correct?
That's absolutely right. And I'd be happy to come back, Yvonne. It's been an honor to be on the show. Thank you for having me. And I'll just say that, you're encouraging people to become members and get on committees. NICL has about 35 different committees. There's around 400 to 500 people at any one given time serving on those committees. And they really do drive the business of NICL. I mean, you're right. We're grassroots. Those committees made up of people with disabilities all around the country are what drives us, what tells us what our positions are going to be. Those positions come from you guys. It's not somebody here in D.C. making that up and then telling you what you have to do. It's the other way around. And thanks for having me. I'm happy to come back and update people anytime you'd like. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. And everyone, have a good night. See you next Sunday night. This is Yvonne Smith signing off.